Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
So without further ado, David Cronenberg.
Okay, and I guess what I'd like to do is start. I'd like to use Naked Lunch as a way to talk about your entire body of work. And I was surprised at how much you kept the spirit of the book, but really made it into your film. And the very first film you made, Transfer, I just watched, and it's set in a snowy field. It immediately reminded me of the ending of Naked Lunch, and has the one of the characters is a psychiatrist who flees into exile to become an artist. And there were echoes even in the student film of Naked Lunch. So I don't know. So I wanted to really start by start with the ending of Naked Lunch as a way to get back into talking about all of your films. And the first thing I wanted to ask you about was just the idea of anexia and what that means. The idea of the artist in exile.
Oh, well, anexia is Canada, of course.
Right. Right.
I mean, all Canadians recognize it when they see that scene. And, you know, next year in anexia. But the sequel will take place in anexia.
You've said a number of interesting things over the years about being a Canadian artist, what it means to be Canadian.
Well, for most Canadians define themselves as not being American. I mean, that's the truth. Canada was formed in defense against the 13 colonies, and I think that continues. The idea, the first thing a Canadian is going to say if a Frenchman says, well, what's the difference, is, well, we're not Americans. That's what they say. And we have a very ambivalent love-hate relationship with the U.S., which most Americans are completely and wonderfully oblivious to, which is one of the reasons for the hate, you understand. So I think Marshall McLuhan said that one of the reasons that he was able to make such trenchant philosophical observations on American media was because he did not exist in the middle of it, that he was, as you put it, in a backwater of culture, that is Toronto, and that he was therefore able to observe America from that strange, ambivalent standpoint that all Canadians have. So I think there's a sense that all Canadians, in a way, are outsiders vis-a-vis American culture, very affected by it, can't get away from it, are constantly trying to define what is uniquely Canadian in a sort of a vacuum, in a limbo. And my argument always is that to consider Canada without considering the U.S. is actually an impossibility right from the very beginning. So this does not make me popular in certain circles, you understand?
And then was there, when you were interested in Burroughs and when you were writing fiction and were influenced by Burroughs earlier in your career, before you were making films. Burroughs himself sees himself as an outsider to American culture. And I just wonder what the
He does and he doesn't. I mean, that's why he's sort of a Canadian. You know, he has the same ambivalent relationship to America, but from within. I mean, right now he's living in Lawrence, Kansas, which I think is geographically is about the absolute center of America. And yet, in order to do his art, he felt he had to get away from America. And, of course, Paul Bowles is an American writer who still lives in Tangier, and yet he's definitely an American writer. In a way, it's a traditional artistic paradox. James Joyce had to get out of Ireland to be Irish. He had to live in Paris, you know. So it's not unique to America, I'm saying. But for Canadians, it is a strange, almost a part of our culture that we are outside America.
What was the influence of Naked Lunch and Burroughs early in your career? Because a film like Stereo feels very much Burroughs' influence. And if you could, I'd just like to.
Well, it's invisible to me, or in retrospect, of course, it isn't. But I've been doing a lot of interviews for Naked Lunch lately. I did 36 in 3 days in London, 12 a day, half an hour each. You don't get up. You know, there's a chair and somebody gets into it. And what it does is it forces you to be analytical about things that you really did totally intuitively. And in a way, telling journalists that you have that you were influenced by William Burroughs as handing them a sword, which they then plunged directly into your guts, and go so far. There was one journalist who's kind of a friend who said, it's possible that without William Burroughs, Cronenberg would be bereft of imagery. And I thought, I don't know what that means, actually. I mean, he's basically talking about plagiarism, isn't he? But the point is that hundreds and thousands of artists have read Burroughs and been influenced by him, and it doesn't necessarily manifest itself in a very directly observable way. And really, when I started making films, I wasn't thinking about Burroughs or literature at all. In fact, it was one of the excitements for me of film was that it was not literature, because I had been a would-be novelist since the age of 5. My father was a writer, and I always assumed I would be a novelist, and I was constantly finding myself doing other people, doing Burroughs, doing Nabokov, another influence. And when I got to film, I was free. I felt totally liberated. I felt, well, I can invent my own art form, because although, of course, I have seen, as much of filmmaking as I can, it wasn't the same relationship that I had to literature. So I felt quite free. And it's just only in retrospect, looking back and saying, well, yeah, I mean, I guess there's a lot of Burroughs there. But when I first read Burroughs, it was kind of more a shock of recognition. Someone much more mature, much more crazed, much more experienced in bizarre ways, who had crystallized things that I was only beginning to grope towards. But, if you don't have an affinity for viruses, reading Burroughs is not going to give you one, And I guess I do, because it's once again, the question of influence and what it really feels like when you're doing your own work is a strange one. People like De Palma talk about Hitchcock, and then, in his films, he will actually reproduce this scenes and the Untouchables from Eisenstein and so on, almost shot for shot. And that's to me, that's very strange. I don't understand that at all, because, of course, you don't come from nowhere. You are influenced. But when you're doing your art, you feel as though you are not influenced. You feel as though you're absolutely inventing it all, and I think that's the way it should feel like that.
You talked about the writing process as being unconscious, and your depiction of the writing process, a naked lunch, is of writing as almost something that comes up from the unconscious. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to know I'd like to know about your approach to when you finally decided to sit down and write the script for Naked Lunch. I mean, you came up with something that was very linear, very different than the novel. Did you try different approaches, or did this... I know in interviews you've said that this seemed to flow right out when you finally decided to write it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it did. I mean, I'd been, I met Burroughs at his 70th birthday party, and then I was at his 75th birthday party, and I still hadn't written a word. And we were kind of saying, it would be nice if William were alive to see this movie. So write something, as they say in Annexia. And Clive Barker was insane enough to offer me the third lead in his movie, Nightbreed, as an actor. And I told him he should get a real actor, but he was determined. So it meant I was going to be in London for about 2.5 months. And then I bought my first laptop and started to write Naked Lunch on the plane going over. And to my surprise, it just was there. It was just there waiting, and it was as much like automatic writing. It was as much as being dictated to by your machine as I've ever had. Now, this was a Toshiba 1200, so if you're interested, I guess I could do an ad for Toshiba. I haven't thought of that. Naked Lunch was there waiting. I think what happened was that I've been thinking about it for so long, the extent of my collaboration with Burroughs was really to just phone him up or go see him and talk to him about strange sort of, I even thought, maybe irrelevant things, just to get, I was kind of steeping myself in the Burroughsian aura, and had gone to Tangier with Jeremy Thomas and Burroughs in 1985, and he would, point out where he had written Naked Lunch and had tea with Kerouac and God knows what else, and introduced us to Paul Bowles and other people who were still there. We talked all the time. And I would ask him things like, you know, so, you know, what about insects, Burroughs? You know, I mean, it seems as though you always use insects in a negative way in your descriptions. When you say someone has cold, blank insect eyes, it's always negative. You know, do you like insects? Are there any? And he said, I kind of like butterflies, he said. And things like, you know, I know you believe in an afterlife, and does this mean that you are not afraid to die? And he said, well, no, you could end up in the wrong company. And things like that. And I suppose that in doing that, I was actually shaping my approach to the film, because I did talk to him about shooting his wife and misogyny and things like that. And I think, did he consider, would he consider using biographical incidents in a fictionalized way to be a legitimate thing for me to do? And he said, absolutely. He didn't separate his life from his art. And he, in fact, thought of his books as one big work. And in other words, basically gave me blessings. This was blessings from the Pope of Interzone to go ahead and do what I had to do. And we talked about sexuality, and I said, you know, mine is different from yours, and I don't know what that's going to mean to the movie. And I just don't want there to be any unpleasant surprises. He said, you know, just it's your movie, do it. Finally, by the time, and there were one or two key issues, I think. One was drugs. I knew that, of course, there would be drugs in the film, but I decided, I think, quite at an early stage that I wanted them to all be invented. Now, certainly there's a precedent for that in Naked Lunch. There are mugwumps who emit addictive fluids in Burroughs. There's the black meat of the giant aquatic Brazilian centipede. But the bug powder was my invention. And except that Burroughs wrote a short story, a memoir called Exterminator, about his time as an exterminator in Chicago. And some of the lines of dialogue in that scene from A.J. Cohen, the you know, you want, I should spit that in your face. That's uh-huh. Directly from Burroughs. That's maybe the most directly I've taken any dialogue, was that first scene, which is not from Naked Lunch. In fact, there are things from Queer, Naked Lunch, and Interzone, which is kind of the outs of Naked Lunch. And we actually had, in fact, contractual right to use those things. And Burroughs, of course, had no objection. I didn't want to use real drugs in the film because I didn't want people to be thinking of Nancy Reagan when they saw the movie. And I didn't want them to think about crack houses in the Bronx and Colombian drug wars and that kind of thing. I wanted it all to reflect internally within the film and to have the references not be quite so topical. And the result of all of this sort of meandering and pondering was finally that when I started to write, it just clicked right into place. And literally, it was as though I was being dictated to. It was wonderful, because I'm basically quite lazy and not a good typist even. So none of the other scripts that I've written worked quite that way, not quite that easily. And, of course, it was having the whole Burroughsian universe to play with that allowed a lot of that to happen.
Since there's very few passages from the novel that literally appear verbatim in the film, but there are a few. I mean, one is certainly when you're reading the novel, there's a lot of passages that strike you as Cronenbergian, remind you of your films, and certainly the one of the talking anus. The passage about that starts with Dr. Benway in the novel talking about how inefficient the human body is. Mm-hmm. And he says, instead of a mouth and an anus to get out of order, why not have one all-purpose whole to eat and eliminate? Mm-hmm. And then the story about the talking asshole.
Yeah.
That seems to that has so many echoes to your other films. I'd just like to start talking about know what that means.
You are the talking asshole. That's what you're saying. But this is not actually an insult, because and I have proof, because what I do point out is that when people say, you know, why are the typewriters so disgusting and they have this orifice and they call it all kinds of things, and we know it's an asshole, and they say, I say, well, you know, there is a structure to the film, and by the end of the film, you have the sort of talking asshole monologue, which is taken basically word from word, word for word from the novel. And you realize, to me, it's obvious that Burroughs is the talking asshole and that I am and that any artist is. And in fact, anybody who says things that society doesn't want to hear, that people don't want to hear, that's the hideous, repulsive orifice that is speaking and saying these things. And you stick candles up it and try and shut it up and it won't shut up. And that's why I wanted the typewriter, which is basically kind of, you know, I don't want to get too Freudian about it because it isn't a Freudian structure, but he is an exterminator. He's exterminating a lot of parts of himself that he would rather not deal with, his homosexuality, his art. And so you can start to say, okay, though the cockroaches are the unconscious thoughts coming out of the crevices of the unconscious, and then the typewriter, of course, is really the writer's unconscious. It's the writer talking to himself when he's talking to his typewriter. It pushes you around. You push yourself around. You aggravate yourself, provoke yourself. And so that's where all that imagery comes together. And it's not a structure that's explicit in Naked Lunch, but as soon as I realized, really to my surprise, that the movie was very much about writing and about the creative act and why should human beings have the impulse to do that and to invent characters and universes and concepts and stuff, then all of that I incorporated in the movie from Naked Lunch works beautifully with those concepts. There's the sort of falling hemorrhoid monologue, of course, is pretty directly from Naked Lunch, but I think it's actually a version that's in Queer that I use. It's slightly different. Burroughs recycles, you know. And there's some other long pieces of the incantations that Martin makes as a poet are also from Naked Lunch, actually. And they're quite beautiful and powerful. Take some questions from the audience. And
sure. Over here.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a sort of a mixed blessing. I mean, when I started to write my first movie as opposed to my first film, which I consider Stereo and Crimes of the Future are sort of films in the sort of underground art sense, and Shivers, which is called They Came From Within Here, that was an AIP title, was my first movie in the sense that it was a professional endeavor. I actually got paid to write it and direct it and so on and was working with other people, whereas the other films were not done that way. And it was just very natural for me to work within the genre. It felt, once again, it wasn't calculated. In retrospect, it seemed like a good way to start. The thing is that the genre does protect you in some ways, and we've seen a lot of young filmmakers protected from their own ineptness and brashness and arrogance and so on, and I include myself in that, by the genre. It kind of mothers you, and because it's a known quantity and you can get away with murder in it and it's okay and you can make a lot of mistakes and the momentum of the genre itself can carry you as well. But it was luck. It wasn't calculation because it was, I was always interested in science fiction and horror writing. But when I came to movies, I was interested in everything. I could have just as easily tried to make a Western, you know, as a horror film. But when I started to write, that was where I got the juice to do it. And then, of course, your first encounters with the press and you blithely proclaim yourself the Baron of Blood, you know, a few other things like that. And once again, this is the sword you have given, which they plunge into every part of your body, because no matter what you do later, you are the Baron of Blood. You know, you are the Horror Meister, and it just doesn't matter what you do, and you're stuck with it. Whereas in fact, where it comes from for me has nothing to do with genre whatsoever. I mean, I'm just not aware of it or thinking about it. It for me, the question of genre is a critical problem or a marketing question. You know, what is this film? How do we sell it? Who's the audience? But it has nothing to do with where the movies come from. It's sort of after you say, well, okay, what is this? You know, I mean, what is Dead Ringers? I don't know what category you would put that film into. Or even The Dead Zone. because it was called The Dead Zone, and Deborah Hill had done Halloween, and I had done what I had done, and Stephen King and so on, it was perceived as a horror film, in effect, sort of sold ineptly, I might say, by Paramount, not Fox, kind of sci-fi hardware, I don't know what, it was very bizarre, and of course it's none of those things, and the book wasn't that either, but it was the associations were so strong that it was almost impossible for people to see the movie for what it was until after a while, you know. And you hope the film lasts long enough so that the audience that might like it will find it. Sometimes it's despite the advertising and sometimes not. So after The Dead Zone, the people who did see the movie for what it was said, well, now it's mainstream and you know, there are no effects in the film to speak of, and it works more on an emotional level, and there's no gore, and there are none of these creatures, and, you know, he's dropped the crutches, he can walk now. And then I did The Fly, you know, which was really a horror film with a lot of effects and a lot of gore. And I would have done The Fly before The Dead Zone or after, depending on when they had come together, or I would have done Dead Ringers before both of them if I'd been able to get the financing together. So I'm not really thinking of, you know, as they like to say, the arc of my career, you know, that kind of stuff. Because it doesn't, it's just not where you make the movies from. It isn't for me anyway. It could, and I don't really think it is for anybody, but it might be. I mean, you might, if you weren't writing the things yourself, you might choose projects to prove a point that you can do a comedy or this or that. And I guess that's possible. And certainly actors do that. But actors can make a lot more films than directors. So for me, it's just a project by project thing. And, the vagaries of the business are such that you never know which of the things you're interested in will go first, will be possible first. And so it would be very hard to orchestrate your career in terms of starting within the genre and then gradually moving into the mainstream and then becoming an art filmmaker or whatever, however you wanted to do it. It would be incredibly difficult to really do that. Is that an answer?
Okay, over here.
I don't think he sees a lot of movies, William. And in fact, he doesn't listen to a lot of music. I noticed that when I was at his place, he didn't have any means of playing music. Which was interesting for me for this film, because I was thinking of asking him for a list of his favorite tunes, you know. And he, you know, he could talk about, he could remember, you know, various musicians that he had heard and so on. But I realized that truly it wasn't that important to him. And Nabokov also confessed he had no ear, that if he went to watch an orchestra, he would literally watch it. He'd said he'd look at the lacquer glinting off the, you know, in the bow, but he wouldn't really hear anything. And I think Burroughs a bit like that. Music is not that important to him. And film is he's excited by it when he comes in contact with it, but he doesn't really have a huge cinema context that he can work out of. And I think he really just saw one or two of my films. He saw Scanners, and we showed him The Fly and stuff. But when I first spoke to him, I'm sure that he hadn't seen anything that I'd done. And I really think it was more on a personal level that he started to have confidence that I could do the film. And also because of Jeremy Thomas as a producer, you know, that we were both real, we were serious, we had done it before. And he'd been involved in a lot of very, you know, sort of iffy kind of attempts to do things with his work. And he was always very amiable about that. I mean, whether it was rock groups or writers, whatever. But I think that's really the truth of it.
Okay. Back the question back here.
Oh, it's vital. If it's right, it can do so many things for a film, and if it's wrong, it can absolutely destroy a film. I'm sure we've all seen films where the music just kept you out of the movie, or made you feel that you were being manipulated so obviously that you refused to respond, and if that happens, you're dead. And music there really are no rules, in fact, but you can make up the your use of music as you go along, or film by film. But and it's a question even scene by scene. You know, is the music there to accentuate something that's already in the scene, or is it there to work in counterpoint against that, or is it there to suggest something that's going to happen that you wouldn't know just from what's on the screen? I mean, there are many, many things that you can do with music. And Howard Shore, who has done almost all the scores except for the Dead Zone, only because he wasn't available for that, I send him the first draft of a script, and we start talking right away. And it's such a subjective thing. I mean, there are more fistfights happening in the sound mix than there are on the set. It's little known, actually. It's probably the most neglected element of filmmaking now that everything else is getting so much publicity, but including editing. But very few people are aware of what goes on in a sound mix. And sound is probably more subjective than anything visual. So it is really, really quite subtle what you do with music. In this case, we say, okay, well, the obvious thing is jazz because they're hip, right? And you know, Charlie Parker. And then, but what about Bird? And what about, okay, if we treat music the way we're treating drugs, we should really invent the music the way we invent the drugs. It's something that you can understand, but that is new for the film so that it reflects internally. And then North Africa. Of course, Interzone has a North African flavor where it's maybe a hallucinated version of it, but still, what about North Africa? And North African music is, in fact, African, not Arabic. It's very rhythmic and so on. Well, you know, if you were strictly doing Moroccan music, you wouldn't have an Arabic influence. But, well, it would be nice to be able to use some Arabic. So, and then Howard said to me, well, you know, there is an instance of a combination of jazz and North African music, and that is a recording that Ornette Coleman did with the master musicians of Jijuka in 1973, and I'll send that to you. And he did. And we did a temporary mix, a temp mix, which is done when you're starting to have some screenings for people to see how they're responding. And you know, even if you know you've made a film yourself, it's very distracting when there are dropouts in the dialogue and there's no music and no effects and so on. So you do a temp mix just to make the film a little smoother. And also it gives you a chance to experiment with the music. And you begin to realize what problems you have and what things that you thought would work in theory. In fact, when you try them, they don't actually work. And you very often use pieces of scores from other movies to try and get a feel for what would work. And in our case, we used a lot of stuff that Howard had written for Dead Ringers and for A Kiss Before Dying, I think, the remake of that. And but we put Ornette's stuff with the North African music exactly where it is here, which is when Bill Lee says, I hear Interzone's really nice this time of year. And then you hear this incredible music, which is a combination of, it's Ornette actually playing. He went up to the mountains. These musicians are, it's really religious music for them. And he played with them, and it was recorded. And it, to me, it sort of became the Interzone national anthem. It's very dissonant and very disturbing, very forceful. And it just works so well in the temp mix. And we did use some Charlie Parker tunes for all the source music. You know, when they come into the apartment, she's shooting up, and you would hear Charlie Parker. And Howard said, well, you know, maybe I know Ornette. Maybe he'd be interested in being involved in the movie. And we sent him a tape of the film with the temp mix. He was living in, or he was traveling anyway. He was in Holland at the time. And he loved the movie. He completely related to it, and speaking about exiles and living outside America to comment on America, I mean, he said to him the movie was about being brilliant in America, and he wanted to be involved very much. So this was really a coup for us. I mean, we were very excited about it, but we didn't know how much he would be involved or what would work. And Howard wrote the opening and ending credit music with Ornette in mind. It was there for Ornette to be improvising over. And he came to London. We were all in London. Ornette improvised with the London Philharmonic Orchestra. That was very interesting. Howard introduced Ornette to these musicians, and some of them were very young, and it was obvious that they had not heard of Ornette Coleman. But they were very politely applauded. He said, "Ladies and gentlemen, Ornette Coleman." They applauded and tapped their bows and so on. And then Ornette has no music in front of him, you know, so this is already very strange. And then they're starting to play, and he just starts doing what he does. And, of course, it's wonderful. And it takes some takes, you know, for both the symphony to get it right and for Ornette to get it right. And after a few takes, a woman, when there was a break, a violinist came up to him. She said, "You're not playing with music." And he said, "No, I'm just kind of, you know, making it up." And she said, "Do you get jobs?" So we assumed that she didn't know who he was. Anyway, so this is a long story, but it's basically to show you that there really are no rules. I mean, it happens very organically, and this happened very much towards the end of the filmmaking process. Sometimes you've got it right from the beginning. As I say, what's exciting and why I feel that it's very legitimate to work with the same people over and over again, which I like to do, which is not really the Hollywood way, because there's always somebody who's the hottest guy. You know, you have to have this cameraman, you have to have this composer. I don't really think you get in a rut by working with the same people, because you're constantly changing, and when you're a filmmaker, when you're a director, your production designer, your cameraman, your composer go off and do other movies while you're trying to get your next one together. So they have other experiences and get a chance to experiment and come back with fresh concepts. And of course, you've got each movie is a unique universe. Not only you hope for the audience that sees it, but it is for you when you make it. So even working with the same people, it's always different and it's always exciting, and that applies to the music. I hope that's enough of an answer.
Okay, down here.
Yeah, I think video is a whole completely other thing, and I'm really delighted about video. In fact, I've never shot a film in widescreen specifically because of video. I compose my films for both an aspect ratio of 1.85. I actually use 1.75 so that it'll work in Europe, which is 1.66:1. That's the shape of the frame, and 1.85 in North America, and it'll also work on TV without having to pan and scan or you know, alter the composition of the frame. Video is always, I've always known that more people are going to see my movies on video right from the very beginning. And it's just, to me, it's just suicide to ignore that and say, well, I make my films for cinema and that's it. It's just not, it can't be true. And certainly for films like Videodrome, ironically enough, which is very much about video, it's almost entire life since it died after the first weekend. But it's still alive. But it's alive on video. And, I mean, I talked to people who saw bootleg cassettes of it in Cuba and stuff like that. And that delighted me, you know, because, of course, it's getting seen. And yet, there's no denying that the video experience is quite a different one. We would not have been able to make either Dead Ringers or Naked Lunch had it not been for video. Pre-sales of video are a crucial element now in the making of any independent film. And it was the belief that both of those films would be very attractive on video that got them financed. Naked Lunch, I might be doing Fox an injustice here, but I don't think so. I think that they really felt that Naked Lunch was for video, and that's why they got the rights to it. And I think they might be pleasantly surprised right now by how well it seems to be doing in the few theaters that it's been running so far. And so it's video is so present for any filmmaker now that, as I say, you can't ignore it. But it is a different experience. So sometimes when people say, I want to see your films, but they're too scary or they're too this or they're too that, I say, well, you know, wait till it's out on tape and then watch it. Because you have more control. You know, you can fast forward, you can stop, you can walk out of the room without feeling guilty and embarrassing yourself. And I really think, and of course it has in some ways a lesser impact on TV, but not always. I always seem to use a lot of close-ups, and my films seem to be quite claustrophobic, and that isn't because of video. That's just because of my own nervous system and my understanding of composition and my feeling that the human face is really what cinema is all about. In fact, talking heads is what movies are all about to me, really. And so they work well. They tend to work well on video. But if you've ever watched a film, you know, with a tape with headphones on at night, 3 a.m, it can be a very intense experience, quite different from a theater, but very intense, maybe more intense in some ways, in an internal way. So, you know, to me, video is the freedom of the image. I mean, I can't imagine now not having access to film the way we do now, but it wasn't that long ago that you just didn't. A film came for a couple of weeks, and it was gone forever. And I saw movies before TV, believe it or not. And that was the way it was. I mean, you had a memory of it. You had some stills, maybe. That was it. It was gone. So it really, oddly enough and bizarrely enough, brings movies around to being more like literature, because you have a bookshelf, you know, except it's a video shelf. You could take your favorite video down. You can fast forward to your favorite scene the way you might do it with a book and reread it, look at it again, analyze it. Fast forward through those parts that you really hate or are boring. And I think that's great. I mean, it's all more involvement, and I embrace it.
Okay, right here. Sorry.
No. I don't waste time on characters who aren't on screen. And I know that some people do, and certainly there are novelists who do that. And you know, you do whatever works for you. But I really wanted them to be kind of almost parentless and almost a product of their own will. And I didn't want to get into that stuff, although it's incredibly fascinating. And certainly the young boys who played the twins as children had parents who were there all the time. And then the relationship between them and us, it was fascinating. But it was really something I didn't want to get into. There was no room in the film to deal with it. And I think part of making a film successful is to just accept that the limitations of the form. You know, I think it was George Bernard Shaw who said, you know, when someone said, well, how long should a play be? He said, well, an act can be no longer than the capacity of the human bladder. I mean, that's really what determines how long an act can be. So I think you have to accept the limitations of the form and work within it. And I was not prepared to deal with that element in Dead Ringers. And I do notice that generally I don't deal with that. It's sort of in retrospect. It's just for some reason, I don't know why, what would happen if I did, but I normally don't deal specifically with those elements of child-parent relationships. I'm not sure why.
Okay. Tom?
I've heard, I don't know for sure if it's true, that originally there was a plan to do the North African sequences in Naked Lunch in North Africa,
mm-hmm.
and then the Gulf War, I think.
Yes, that's true.
I'm curious about the change of deciding to do it, if I'm not mistaken, their shot in Toronto, particularly given Bertolucci shooting the Paul Bowles Children's Gun
yes.
location, the difference of having a Pantier with a Canadian son rather than a...
Mm-hmm. There was no son whatsoever. That's Canada, you know. Well, yes, it's true that we originally, our schedule was set up to shoot at the end of it, for I think a couple of weeks in Tangier. And I was on Bertolucci's set for The Sheltering Sky because Jeremy Thomas also produced that, and that was in a perfect sort of opportunity for me to see what a production in Tangier would be like, what would be the problems and so on. And then 3 days before we started to shoot, the Gulf War broke out. We could see it coming, but you know, you sort of hope that it's not going to happen. And it wasn't so much. I mean, they were saying, you know, all foreigners should probably get out of Tangier because, of course, there was a fundamentalist element in Morocco as well, which the king tries to suppress, but, you know, who knows. And mainly, though, we couldn't get insurance. Even if everybody on the crew and cast had been willing to fly to North Africa, we couldn't get insurance for the production, which would mean that our contracts would be invalid, which would mean we'd have no financing. So it was really the insurance companies who decided it. And I was depressed for a day because, of course, we had done a location survey aside from the sheltering sky experience that I had. And we were always going to build the interiors in Toronto, but when somebody opens a door and you see outside the door, you have to build a bit of what's out there. So we had taken measurements and videotapes and photos and everything, a lot of Tangier, and we're very prepared to shoot there. And then I started to look at the script the weekend before we started to shoot, and I realized that we never should have been going to Tangier. We were really seduced by the reality of Burroughs having written the book there, and through kind of mass hypnosis had all assumed that we must shoot something in Tangier to connect with that. But when I looked at the script with a very cold eye, I realized, of course, that Interzone is always a state of mind, and that technically he's probably never left New York. In fact, he probably hasn't left his apartment. And that I was being forced by circumstances to take that one final step, which would use that rather than just have it be there. And that's when we started to blend the Tangier stuff or the Interzone stuff, really, more correctly. For example, when Hank and Martin come back to his apartment, it's really a combination of his Interzone apartment and his New York apartment. And sometimes outside a window you'll see Central Park, and sometimes you'll see Tangier, and sometimes you'll see, you know, tenements. That all came into the film afterwards, after we couldn't go to Tangier. Although, as I say, the concept was there begging to be used, you know. So when I presented the rewritten script to Jeremy, and, you know, everybody was kind of saying, oh, sure, it's better, yeah. You know, they kind of, you're rationalizing it because you have no choice. It was better, and it was obvious to everybody, every actor, everybody, that it was just that final step. It was that last draft that should have been written before and was finally. And, of course, my production people were incredibly excited because it's much more of a challenge to build the Casbah than to go and shoot in it, although I'm sure that's a challenge, too. So that's really the way it happened.
Can you speak a little bit about working with Jeremy Irons and the process of providing the Casbah and what you were going for and that thing?
Well, sure. Jeremy Irons and Dead Ringers. I'm going to try and remember now. I mean, basically, the reason that I had so much trouble getting someone to do that role was, first of all, gynecology. No American actor could get... Well, I won't say none. I went to 30 of the best American actors. The names would astound you. And most of them could not get past the third page because there was gynecology. Now, this is interesting, don't you think? And the other thing that scared them was schizophrenia. They were afraid of the role. And you'd think that any actor would want to be on screen by himself with himself. That is a dream role. And Jeremy was very upfront about that. But in fact, the thing that this script demanded was not what most twin scripts demanded. And there are a lot of twin scripts around. I mean, also I went to 40 pitch meetings for Dead Ringers and couldn't sell the movie. And that's why I ended up producing it myself. And they would say, we've got a twin script right here we'd be happy to do, but please not that one. You know, couldn't they be lawyers? Things like that. Do they have to both die? So it wasn't the fact of twins. It was the fact that they were real twins. And twins love this movie because they have never seen themselves on screen before for real. Because almost inevitably, a twin script is about a crazed, psychotic, killer twin and a good, wonderful twin. It's good and evil, you know, all that stuff. And this movie didn't give an actor that shtick to fall back on. This movie was two real people who were very much like each other but not identical and very subtly different. And that was going to be really hard to play. And I think one very famous actor said to me that he would have to drive himself over the edge of madness to play this role. And people who knew him said it was not a long trip. But I never got to find out, so I don't know. Anyway, Jeremy was the... I had to have an actor who spoke English as his first language. You know, this to me was important because the dialogue was important, and that was the role. Jeremy was the first English actor that I went to, and he was the first actor who said, I'm very interested in this, I want to meet you and talk to you about it. I don't know how he did it, you know. I do know that he used some physical tricks to psych into the role, and by the end of the shoot, we would be whipping him in and out of Beverly and Elliot instantly. You know, there's no, like, we'll do one day of Beverly and one day of Elliot. It's impossible to do that. He developed small physical things that he did. For example, for Beverly, he would stand weighted on his heels and slump a bit. And it just immediately, just that posture and a few hair things would put him into Beverly. And then Elliot would stand with the weight on the balls of his feet more aggressively, and that would change his posture, and he would immediately become Elliot. You know, now, I don't know. I didn't have to do that in Nightbreed, so I didn't ever figure that out. But it was hard to figure out how to drink a cup of coffee and say a line of dialogue at the same time. That was very tricky, believe me. So... And then the way I work with an actor is very collaborative, not in the sense of improvising dialogue, because I don't do that. I take a long time with the script, and I want to do it that way, unless there's some line that really doesn't feel right and the actor just can't make it feel play. But in terms of the way we choreograph the scenes and our understanding of the way the scenes play, it's very collaborative. It's constant little adjustments and fine tunings, and we'd have to get very specific about a scene, you know. But because you work out the basic strokes of it I don't really do rehearsals. It just doesn't interest me to do that. I do it on the day. And if there are problems that the actor has with the scene, understanding it or believing that it works, then of course you talk about it up front. But basically, the way the day begins, I have to do it this way, I'm afraid. You know, I clear the set of everybody except the script person who will feed you lines if you forget them, and myself and the actors. And we start to block the scene as though it's a play. I mean, we really start to say, well, will you be sitting and saying that line? And then you get up to the window, and then you pause, and then you turn, and then you say, you know, you start to do that. And then work out the entire scene that way as a little playlet. Then you call all the crew on and run it again for them, and also for the stand-ins who have to walk it while you're lighting and so on. And then I'll talk to various people. The sound man will say, this is going to be very hard to boom. Maybe you have to use radio mics. The cinematographer will say, I'm worried about when you have them go up to the window. Maybe it'd be better if you went over here visually, and you try to integrate that into the dramatics and so on. During that time, that's when you have the actors have you as a director there, and that's when it happens. That's when you really create the scene from an acting point of view, and then I start to work with everybody else to get it to work cinematically. And it's very rare that I have such a specific visual idea that I subordinate everything to that, you know, that I know I'm going to do this long dolly shot, so he has to be standing there, and I don't care if he feels like he should be over at the piano, he has to be there. I don't usually do that. And then while you're shooting, you find other things, and it's all minor adjustments and movements, and different things happen in the wide shot than they do in the close-up. So it's very, very difficult for me to be more specific. I could certainly analyze what might have happened during a specific scene that way. But I can't really be much more specific than that.
The question I have for you is, in an interview you gave in the book that you had about your Polish program.
Yes.
You mentioned that you're working on the original script. But most of the films that were made after the video films were all adaptations.
Mm-hmm.
Are you working on more original scripts?
Well, it's interesting about original scripts. I mean, I know it might seem unbelievable, but it really all feels the same to me. To write the script for Naked Lunch, when I was starting and being, you know, very much auteurist in my aspirations, I really felt that, you know, you must do everything original and all of that. And I still do think that my writing is one of my main strengths as a director. But there are many ways that expresses itself. And in a way, it almost doesn't matter where the basics come from, the material that you start with, whether it is in fact a dream or somebody else's dream or somebody's book or a story that someone told you or a story that you read in the New York Times. So I myself am not particularly obsessed with that. And as I say, I mean, Naked Lunch, writing Naked Lunch felt as satisfying to me as writing Videodrome, maybe more because I had more time to do it and rewrite it than I did with Videodrome. So I am working on a couple of scripts now. One is an original, but it's based on the lives of some real people. And in a sense, at the moment, it looks as though they're going to still have those names when the movie comes out, well, when the script is written. Another one is an adaptation of J.G. Ballard's book Crash. And, you know, that is like a dream I had. So I don't know. I mean, will there be one that isn't technically based on something else? At the moment, I'm not working on one that's like that exactly. As I say, I'm actually working on a script about racing cars. Well, that's better than the Baron of Blood. That's good. That's good. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, right here.
Yeah, well, I don't really think of it that way at all, and I actually don't think I'm obsessed at all. You know, I don't think of myself as an obsessive person. Not truly. I know some truly obsessive people, and I don't feel that the way it works with me is quite that. But no, actually, my crazed doctors and scientists are my heroes. Really, I like them, and. They're my artists. I mean, sometimes I'm talking about artists, writers, and sculptors, and sometimes they're the scientists. But really, I think they're just doing an extreme version of what I think we all do, which is to try to invent the world for ourselves, and to try to interpret it, and to try to gain some control over it. So I know this is. I mean, that's the way it feels to me, and I think that. They're exhilarating to watch, even though they might be insane and might be, you know, veering towards destruction all the time. I think that they're, you know, that's what you want to watch, and I know that. And so in that sense, they're my heroes because it's what they do and how extreme they are that starts to illuminate things in the film. So I don't really think of myself as anti-medical or anti-scientific. I mean, I think that it's innate in human nature to do those things, to not be satisfied with the way things are, to not be satisfied with things as basic as a human body. We've been redesigning ourselves from the beginning. I mean, we've never accepted sitting in the middle of the field or a forest the way monkeys do. You know, we built our own world, our own environment, and we're building our own bodies. And so in that maybe slightly perverse sense, they are my heroes, and certainly in terms of the dynamics of the film, they are my heroes. So I'm not really, you know, we could get into, do you trust doctors and lawyers, and that's a whole other question.
Okay, over here.
Well, that's a few questions. I don't really think about my reputation when I'm writing. You really try to divest yourself of all of those considerations because of your career, of how you will be perceived, how the critics will perceive you, whether they'll think you're doing something that's retrograde, whether you're going to be hammered by the feminist right wing or the gay activist left wing. You've got to get rid of all that stuff. You can't worry about it. For many reasons, the primary one being that if you do that, you will paralyze yourself before you set down a word. You just don't have enough time to consider all those kind of variables, which are really not calculable anyway. The other thing is that you never know which movie that you're trying to make is actually going to go when. So you can't, you know, talk in advance about the arc of your career or anything like that because, for example, I would have made Dead Ringers in 1981 if I could have got the financing together. That would have shuffled the deck, really, in terms of critical appraisal of your chronology. After I did The Dead Zone, critics were saying, well, not just critics, you know, now he's entering the mainstream and no more special effects and this is a very emotional film and it's rural instead of urban and, you know, all that stuff. All of it was true, except that then I made The Fly, you know, right after it. And then after Dead Ringers, which was an effects film, but not visibly, and was considered by people to be, I suppose, more realistic, whatever that is. Yeah. No, but you see, a lot of people didn't consider The Dead Zone a horror film, and I don't either. But the other thing is that those kind of categories are really a critical problem or a marketing problem, but they're not a creative problem. I mean, it's irrelevant when you're doing the thing, whether it's a horror film or a quasi-horror film or a science fiction horror film. That's completely irrelevant. You don't draw any shape from that or any energy from that. It really doesn't do anything for the way you're working. So it's not something that's part of the creative process. And it's only after the fact that you start to see that the fact that it's difficult to figure out how to sell the movie, for example, because your last film was a horror film and it did well. So do you mention The Fly when you're trying to sell Dead Ringers? You know, that's the kind of problem it is. But it's not a creative problem. You sort of are, after the fact, you get analytical about things that you were, in fact, only intuitive about while you were doing it. The insect typewriters are my invention. Thank you. Well, I have to say that Burroughs himself loved and wanted to take them home off the set. And he does have a mugwump in his bedroom, I can tell you that. And it's tied up, though. It's okay. Said that he thought any writer could relate to those typewriters, which was a huge compliment. And I must say that Burroughs was totally supportive and very easy about the making of the film. I mean, he always, as he's written in the preface to the, there's a book, The Making of Naked Lunch as well, which is not out yet, but it will be in about a week. And in a preface that he's written, he mentions a story about Raymond Chandler when people said, you know, aren't you appalled at the things that Hollywood has done to your books? And he said, well, Hollywood hasn't done anything to my books. They're right there on the shelf. And I think that's really Burroughs' approach. His work is his work, and nothing that I could do would ever change it, really. Yeah. Well, the William Tell routine and the killing of Joan, until I started to write the screenplay, I wasn't really sure how I was going to approach doing the book, and I really avoided it for many years. You know, I was at Burroughs' 70th birthday party, and then I was at his 75th birthday party. I still hadn't written a word, and we thought, well, you know, if William is going to see this movie, maybe we better start doing something. But I was, in fact, gathering keystones or points of reference almost unconsciously, I think. And I was really struck by the preface that he wrote to the book Queer. And we had the rights, really, to use Queer Interzone, which is kind of the outs of Naked Lunch, Exterminator, which was a group of short pieces, the title one being a short memoir of his time as an exterminator in Chicago. In the preface to Queer, he says that at a certain point in his life, he was forced to come to the appalling conclusion, he says, that had it not been for the shooting death of his wife, Joan, he would not have become a writer. And that really just struck me with incredible force. And I knew that I had to have that in the film in a very fictionalized way. And I wasn't sure why. And in a sense, when I make a film, I'm really making the film to find out why I want to make it. I absolutely am not sure why I want to make it until it's finished. And even then, it takes some time to settle in. And I think that's what gives me the drive to continue through all the agony that you do go through. And there's fun, too, but, I mean, it's tough. It's to find out why you are obsessed. No, I won't use that word. To find out why you are focused on that particular project. People said, why do you want to make this story about, you know, the twin gynecologists, they end up dead. I tried to, we pitched that to about 40, literally 40 or more meetings in Hollywood. And you can go back to the same office again, you know, because next week is all new executives. So, And you also run into the situation where you go into an office and they say, yo, when I was at TriStar, you know, I was a minor executive and I loved your project and I just couldn't do anything. I didn't have the power. Now let's do it again. And so you say, here it is. It's about these twin gynecologists. And, you know, they end up sort of dead. It's great. And then they say, we'll get back to you. And then you go the next day, they said, no. Well, I have the power this time. No. So 40 meetings, and yet I have to say that one of the difficulties, it was really partly my fault because I couldn't tell the story in the way, well, you can't tell the movie. And in particular, I can't tell the movie because I haven't written it. I hadn't written it at that point because you kind of want the studio to pay you while you're writing it so you can survive. And after they see the movie, they say, oh, right, now I see what you meant. But I can't give them the movie before I make it, and the main reason is because I don't know quite what it is on that very basic level. I didn't know until I really got into writing the script of Naked Lunch that it was, my version of it was about writing, that it was, I went back to Burroughs to get to the root of the need to be creative, the human need that's unique, as far as I know, on Earth and maybe in the universe, to invent characters, to recreate things in a different way, to try to bring chaos, order out of chaos, to give meaning to things that might you suspect be meaningless, that kind of thing. And so the film, in a way, became a meditation on writing, using the Burroughsian example, I suppose is what it is. And that's basically how that happened.
Okay, back there.
I wonder if I could ask you what your personal perception have you found any differences in audiences or critics' perceptions of your films in Canada as opposed to the U.S.? Or is there something distinct about the American experience?
Well, in terms of the response to the film, it's a little early to say because it's only just opened in Canada on the 10th, really. It played in 5 theaters in the U.S. early, just in order for it to qualify for the Academy Awards. This was we'll see about that. A little optimistic, but why not? And then, so I really can't talk specifically about the difference in reaction because the Canadian reaction is just happening this weekend, and I'm not there, so I don't know. I mean, we got 3 good reviews in the 3 main Toronto papers, but they were very different in their approaches. And you know, you can get a good review that you think is not so smart, and that puts you in a very strange place because you want a good review, but it's what you fear, of course, is an intelligent bad review. You really hope you won't get one of those. And so far, I haven't had any of those, but it's possible. I know it's possible. Now, what was the other part? Yeah, well, censorship is a huge issue, and maybe I can only say that I really think that as an artist, and I guess this really Nabokov said it, and I think he was right, that you have no social responsibility as an artist. You must not censor. You cannot self-censor, and you must fight to not have any of your work censored. And I think that's absolutely true. there is a strange, uneasy relationship always between society and art. It's inevitable. I mean, I think part of it is because art's primary appeal is to the unconscious. I'm not speaking in strictly Freudian terms, but it's good enough. And society, as in one of the Freudian formulas, this is also a gross simplification, but, you know, civilization is repression. That's one of the formulas. So if art appeals to the unconsciousness, but civilization is repression, you get a very strange relationship between the two. And so censorship will never go away. It's an unending process. I mean, it will never go away. There will always be an element, a desire to repress or censor coming out of a culture, any culture. There's not a culture in the world that has zero censorship. No, there's no studio. There is no studio involved here. This is an independent film that's being distributed in the U.S. by Fox, but that's it. This is not a studio picture. It's an independent film produced by Jeremy Thomas, and believe me, he paid the price in blood, which I don't think we really. It was never. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, imagine this if you want a few laughs. Going into, you know, the head of Fox and putting Naked Lunch, slapping it down on the table and say, "Read this, and we'll get back to you tomorrow." You know, we're going to talk about the movie. Well, that would be fun. it's just not a project that could ever have come out of an American studio. It's just not possible. And it is a bit of a miracle that a major studio is distributing it. But on the other hand, they got a really good deal. You know, they know that. I mean, they've already made money on the video aspect of it, and the fact that it seems to be doing okay at the box office in the limited release that it has is just kind of a surprise to them, I think. So it's a, you know, once again, that to me is the basic structure of those things.
Okay, right here.
I think that the bizarre and maybe somewhat unacceptable truth is that there is no single reality. You know, we structure it. I mean, it comes out of our biochemistry, and then it comes out of the culture that we're born into. And then we get these little intimations that it's not an absolute at all, that in fact, I mean, it's really quite variable and changeable. And you can change reality through in many ways. But I mean, if you imagine that we were, our biochemistry was such that we had an organ that secreted LSD, which is, to me, quite a possibility. You know, it's I can imagine a creature like that. We could still function quite well, but it would be a totally different reality completely. I mean, in terms of time and space and color and shape and tactility and everything. I mean, it would be completely alien reality. And it's very possible. And so Bill Lee, I mean, I can give you a quick little sketch of the structure. You know, this is me being a critic, you understand, and I might not be very good at it because, once again, it's not what I do. I don't sketch this on a pad when I'm trying to figure out how to do the film. I work through intuition. And when the things feel as though they're clicking into place, you have confidence that later they will be able to be subjected to a sort of intellectual analysis and it'll still work, but you're never really sure. If Bill Lee is an exterminator and he is exterminating some elements of his own makeup, his homosexuality, his creativity, because he's afraid, because they leave him vulnerable, because in the 50s those things were not particularly acceptable to the official reality of the times, and he didn't want to expend the energy to fight against that. And there is some biographical truth there. I'll just mention that although Burroughs and Ginsberg were sort of considered the hippest of the hip, or maybe in retrospect were, they bought the official reality of the Eisenhower era enough that they both considered their homosexuality to be curable diseases, curable by psychoanalysis, possibly by drugs. You know, it took a long time before that understanding of that was considered archaic and maybe laughable. But even they wrote about it to each other and talked about it. And Ginsberg in particular tried very hard to turn himself into a heterosexual, very hard. So, but here he is an exterminator. And, of course, if you get into Freudian symbology, you get, you know, these things, these kind of, to me not repulsive, but to most people repulsive, these, in fact, Madagascar cockroaches, which are really about that long. And quite pretty, really. But they are the, you know, what comes up from the dark crevices of the mind but the unconscious thoughts, the unconscious desires which we repress. So there's Bill Lee trying to exterminate them. And that's why his typewriter, his typing machine, when it becomes the means of delivering back to him these the things of his unconsciousness, should take the form of an insect. And so that's why the typewriter also has a talking asshole, you know. And in a way, that's Bill Lee talking to himself. So is it not reality? Has he lost touch with reality? No, I think he's very much in touch with reality. It's just a different version of it, a different level of it. And then what he does is, he creates a place, interzone, where everyone recognizes him for what he is. They're all saying, you know, you could jump into bed with this guy, you could jump into bed with that guy. And he's saying, why are you saying these things to me? You know, I'm not a homosexual. And they're saying, yeah, you could write this report with that machine and write that. And he's saying, well, you know, I'm just writing reports. I mean, I'm not really a writer. So he's actually created a place where he must be what he should be. And that's basically my structure.
Basically, it saves the way he used to survive.
Yes.
His life, almost like Marty Lang in schizophrenia.
Yes. How well is the film doing? Because he's from L.A., that's Bob. I'm actually not sure. All I can tell you, I haven't gotten the figures for this weekend because it's not over yet, but... I was speaking of horror films and the box office and so on. A horror film traditionally drops 37% the second weekend, so it sort of suggests that most people who want to see a horror film come out for the first weekend, and then it kind of trails off. And each weekend after that, or each week, it drops quite a lot. So that's why often, you know, Friday the 13th sequel will be in 2,000 theaters, because you hit them hard and then you're gone, you know. But Naked Lunch only dropped 1% from the first weekend to the second. Now, that's only in 5 theaters, but I've never had a film that held like that. So if that's any indication, then it could be a very interesting experiment, because we really are releasing this film in very few theaters. So that it could work very well. So the auguries are good, Bob. They're good. Trust me on this. No, but sometimes it's not a question of how it's being sold. It's people's perception of it is often the way the film is sold is not necessarily the way it's perceived. The Dead Zone, for example, was not a horror film at all, and not really even a science fiction film, but because Deborah Hill had worked on it and she was well known for Halloween, and I worked on it, and it was a Stephen King book as the basis of it, it was perceived as a horror film, and that's really how it acted, even though it wasn't quite sold that way either. So sometimes there's a disjoint between the two.
Okay, over here.
How do you feel about being so well-received?
Well, it's strange. I mean, I just came from seeing Dennis Potter's film, Secret Friends, and Dennis was there, and he was an absolute wreck. And it didn't matter whether people said they loved his film or kind of just didn't talk to him. He was still a wreck, and although externally I'm not shaky like he was, it's a strange thing, you know. I mean, of course you want this. I mean, you want people to love what you're doing, but it's very strange. I haven't figured it out yet, and there are enough strange and negative things that happen that keep you balanced, you know. I'm not likely to get unbalanced, because we have had some bad reviews for it from some quite definitely negative reviews, and so it's not as though it's all positive, you know. And every screening, maybe not here, but every screening, there are walkouts, which does not always happen. Even if people don't like your film, they don't leave. Now, I haven't had the experience that I really want to have, which is to sit with a paying audience at a kind of normal theater, not in a museum situation. And an audience that doesn't know I'm there and that owes me nothing, and that will, you know, if they hate the film, will know that. You know, I haven't had that experience with this film yet, because I had to leave to come here when it opened in Toronto. Normally I'd be there Friday night sitting, you know, squenched down, sweating really a lot in a theater. I need that experience because I can't really respond to the film myself anymore. You see, I have to do it vicariously through the audience because, of course, every cut, every moment in the film has a huge history for me, and I can't really see it. There comes a time when you would, well, most of the time, especially, of course, when you're editing, you would give anything to be able to erase the history of the film from your mind and walk in and see it cold, like a normal audience, just to have that objectivity and that clarity. But you never, ever get that. So you do tricks to try and, you know, give yourself as much of that as you can. And you're wary even about people telling you that they like the film, you know, because you can get awfully picky. It's like, but did you like it the right way, you know? And that's completely unfair, and in fact it's ridiculous because at the same time you know that the response to the film is so totally subjective. It's like music, really, in a way, finally. It's so subjective that it's almost beyond articulation. And when you read reviews, you're looking for that one review, and I do read them. I mean, if it's a really horrible one, then it's too masochistic to read, you know. But if it's not totally horrible, you'll read it, especially the first 30 or 40. By the time you've had 200 or 300 and your film has gone on to be in 40 countries, sort of, you just don't care what anybody thinks anymore because you've got to be working on your next film. But and you sort of pray for that after a while, to just be that insensitive to it. But you look for a review that's really, really intelligent and profound, in the sense that it gets to the heart of something that actually you didn't get to yourself. Because a good critic actually can tell you something about your film that's true that you couldn't articulate yourself. And it's incredibly exciting, and it's quite emotional when you connect with a review like that. I haven't seen one like that yet for Naked Lunch. But it's hard for a reviewer, as opposed to a critic, someone who has to sort of write for a paper, limited space, quick response. As for a film as complex as Naked Lunch, I mean, they can only deal with one element of it. Most of them choose to deal with Burroughs a bit, you know, and then by the end of the review, they're just sort of mentioning things, but they can't really deal with them. So I'm still waiting for that one.
Okay, right back there.
I don't have. There are a lot of directors that are. I don't have a favorite director or two or three. I really don't. I love, you know, Fellini and Godard and Bergman were all very important to me. And the reason that I mention three European directors is simply I was raised on Hollywood stuff. You know, I used to see Hopalong Cassidy and The Durango Kid and Burt Lancaster pirate movies and loved them all and was very exhilarated by them and obviously very influenced by them, in the sense that they delivered to me my understanding of what movies could be. But I never thought of films as art with a capital A until I could tell you exactly when that happened. I used to go to a theater in Toronto called the Pylon. That was before television, believe it or not. We used to all walk to, every Saturday, it would be like lemmings going to the ocean to jump in, you know. We would be streaming towards these cinemas. And you'd meet your friends along the way, and you'd stop off at various shops along the way to buy, you know, gum or something. And you'd go to see a movie. And across the street, where I grew up in Toronto, there was a big Italian population because it was a sort of an immigrant section of town. And that wave of immigration was Italian. So there was an Italian cinema across the street called the Studio, which only showed Italian films in Italian, no subtitles. And I remember coming out of the Pylon and seeing a lot of people coming out of the Studio. And when I looked, I saw that they were men and women, but mostly men, and they were crying coming out of the theater. And I couldn't believe it. The thought that a film could make a grown man cry was astonishing to me. I remember crossing the road to look to see what the film was, and it was Fellini's film La Strada. And that really struck me and said to me, you know, that film can be something besides Hopalong Cassidy, much as that was great. So the influences on me are enormous, but in that sense, you know, they're so diffuse. I couldn't really point. I've not been haunted by one filmmaker the way De Palma says he is by Hitchcock or you know, whatever. It's I don't have that feeling that there is one filmmaker looking over my shoulder saying, no, no, that's, the camera should go a little lower, you know. It's not like that.
Okay, in the first row, and then...
Well, Crash, I haven't written a... Well, no, that's not true. I've written a few words on Crash, actually. Jeremy Thomas and I have bought an option that's been going on for some time for the book. And I've met Ballard a couple of times, most recently just about two weeks ago in London. I was there doing publicity for Naked Lunch. And I don't know what's going to happen with that. I mean, we understand from our experience with Naked Lunch that I have to write the script. Then Jeremy needs about half a year to a year to raise the money for it based on the script, because we cannot just show someone the book. It won't work. Same thing as Naked Lunch, basically. I mean, it's a different book, but it's rough. And if you're a producer, you know you can't just show somebody that. So, and I don't know what my approach will be. You have an enormous problem. It's not a problem. I mean, it's just in the nature of it. Books and film are completely different. And things that are incredibly easy to do in a book, inner monologues and the use of metaphor, are impossible, really, on film. They just don't work the same way. So a lot of what I do with effects in Naked Lunch is my version of metaphor. It's not an attempt, for example, that the fact that I give all the good sex to the rubber in Naked Lunch is not to avoid, and none to the actors, is not to avoid censorship, but to try to reproduce that metaphorical thing that happens in Burroughs when you read all this bizarre sex, which is not pornographic because it's doing a whole bunch of stuff, but if you had your lead actors on screen doing it, it would be probably legitimately considered pornographic, and it would... And I'm talking from an aesthetic point of view now, not a sensorial one. Therefore, it would not be doing the right thing for your film. So, it's those kind of interpretive things are what you deal with. What I deal with when I'm working with a book, which I've only done twice, and of course, The Dead Zone was quite a different thing in many ways, but had similar problems. I don't know what I'm going to do with Crash. I mean, in a sense, you'd say, well, it's more likely to be a movie because it does have characters that continue all the way through, which I do feel the need of. And it does have a narrative of sorts, but it has a lot of other things that I don't know how I'm going to do it. I really don't. So that's where that is right now.
Okay. We can just have time for one more question. So I called on you already.
First, I think more about reality and so forth. In Naked Lunch, we're given several steps out of building reality.
Mm-hmm. In Videodrome.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there was a lot of discussion between myself and the producers on Videodrome, but the structure there is different from Naked Lunch. In Videodrome, I'm presenting a character who it's a first-person film in a total way, so that I just decided that I was going to be very rigorous about it, even though I knew it was a little suicidal, in that as my character's reality changed, so too would the reality of the movie and the reality that was there for the audience. And I was not going to show anybody else's version of it, because that was the only version there was. In the same way that if your own reality were changing, shifting, that would be all you have. I mean, I could make up, you know, what would a passerby see when Max Wren is doing this, you know, and I could, I thought of those things, but I never bothered to schematically work it out because it was irrelevant, basically. In Naked Lunch, it's different because there's a sense that Bill Lee is on a very real level conscious of the fact that he is creating his own reality, first with drugs and then with his art. And he knows. There is a sense, I wanted to suggest that it's not just the audience who knows what's going on. It's also Bill Lee who knows what's going on. And yet he is willful enough and focused enough to continue that, despite the fact that it's dangerous. So that's why I gave little hints of some outside reality in Naked Lunch and didn't in Videodrome. A different sort of project that way.
Just also, you mentioned earlier that you felt your writing was one of the main strengths as a director.
Mm-hmm.
You also spoke of your camera is also very deliberate and live.
Yeah.
What said it was a lens that didn't see a proper competition with Bobbitt.
Yes, true. Fortunately, not with other people's films, though.
Oh, yeah. But I was wondering, I when you said earlier you thought of writing for strength, I tried mm-hmm. to think.
That there are tricks you can do, and one of the tricks is that you surround yourself with really talented people so that they can compensate for your own weaknesses. And if you work with them enough and they become friendly, you can actually confess to them that you just don't know what the fuck you're doing. Will you please help me? But, I mean, that's a joke, but it's not a joke. You know, one of the fascinating things about making a film is that it is so complex. I mean, it does draw on every part of you because it draws on the social part as well, and on the sort of temperament part, and on the dealing with a lot of people part, and dealing with yourself in the way that writing does. It's and dealing with the economy. I mean, I had to produce Dead Ringers because nobody else would do it, and I had to deal with all that stuff that really bores me and I hate, but I had to do it. So instead of taking a nap at lunchtime, which is what I do to maintain my sanity, I had to get on the phone and try to find out why the French deal fell apart. Where's the French distribution deal? Where's that money? It's impossible to be good at every aspect of film. I really do believe it's impossible to be on a level of real excellence on every level. But if you're shrewd and clever, then it's like Muhammad Ali, you know. So you don't have a punch, okay, but you can, you know, you invent rope-a-dope. I mean, I often feel that I'm on the ropes and I'm getting pummeled, but, you know, the ropes are, they're giving me a bit of help. So and one way to deal with that is to find people that you can trust, who you can work with, who understand it, and who have that sense of whatever, if it's a sense of style, if it's a sense of color, if it's whatever you feel that, and it might vary from film to film. I mean, something that you felt really on top of on one film, you feel is you just don't have the maximum on another film. And you find somebody to help you. That's really what you do.
Thanks a lot to David Cronenberg.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.